content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue and the Teen Magazine. The first article is titled, The Scientists Who Made the COVID Vaccine Possible on how the Pandemic Will End, by Elizabeth Yuko, published June 15, 2022 in Teen Vogue. As a scientist, Catalina Carrico's work was focused on finding new, often unorthodox ways to solve problems, an approach she also has taken in her own life. For instance, in 1985, when her university was no longer able to fund her research, Carrico, her husband, and her two-year-old daughter immigrated from their native Hungary to the United States, where she had secured a postdoctoral position at Temple University in Philadelphia, according to the New York Times. At the time, the Hungarian government only permitted them to leave the country with $100 cash, so the young couple sewed the rest of their savings, what would amount to approximately $1,200 today, inside their daughter's teddy bear. In the United States, Carrico, PhD and biochemist, continued the research she began in Hungary on a subject that remains her focus to this day, messenger RNA, or mRNA, molecules that carry the genetic information needed to make proteins from one part of a cell to another. By now, you're likely familiar with the mRNA therapy as the technology that made it possible for Pfizer and Moderna to develop their COVID-19 vaccines at an unprecedented speed in 2020. But before being hailed as one of the heroes of the pandemic, Carrico and her work were largely ignored, dismissed, and flat-out rejected by her peers, potential funders, and lending scientific publications. The tide began to turn for Carrico in 1998, when she met Drew Weissman, MD and PhD, an immunologist and the Roberts Family Professor of Vaccine Research at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, who was interested in making an HIV vaccine using mRNA technology. In 2005, their research partnership began, yielding a series of discoveries demonstrating that mRNA could be used for that purpose. But for the next 15 years, their breakthroughs garnered little attention. That is, until they were used to create life-saving COVID vaccines during a pandemic in record time. Although Carrico and Weissman were never in it for the accolades, they have received many over the past 2 years. For Carrico, now an adjunct professor of neurosurgery at Penn Medicine and a senior vice president at BioNTech, this includes having a minor planet and at least one child named after her. Most recently, the Feinstein Institutes for Medical Research and journal Molecular Medicine awarded the pair the Ross Prize in Molecular Medicine for their mRNA discoveries. Teen Vogue caught up with Carrico and Weissman after they accepted the award. Teen Vogue, why do you think that mRNA technology was such a tough sell for so long? Carrico, once the Human Genome Project started in 1990, as scientists discovered the genes that are responsible for some diseases, it seemed like all the potential was in gene therapy. But the RNA, instability, was a problem. Working with it was not logistically feasible. It wasn't easy to use, and it needed a lot of improvement. Weissman, the other big problem is that it was used in multiple cancer clinical trials, but they had all failed. So I think biotech and pharmaceutical companies thought the stuff was hard to work with and they weren't interested in it. If SARS-CoV-2 mutates to the point where it's able to evade the existing COVID-19 vaccine protection, what would be the process of creating a new COVID-19 mRNA vaccine evolve? What would the process of creating a new COVID-19 mRNA vaccine involve? Kiriko. As each new variant emerges, a clinical trial on a vaccine targeting it has started right away. But you didn't hear about them because they didn't get past phase one, because these new vaccine candidates weren't more potent than the original COVID-19 vaccine when it's used one or two or three times. Weissman, BioNTech CEO, said last year that it would take them 6 weeks to change the vaccine and have it in people's arms, so the process can now be incredibly fast. Every year, we make a new flu vaccine, but we have to guess at what the strain will be 6 to 7 months beforehand, because that's how long it takes to make an egg vaccine. Now, with RNA, we can do that 6 weeks ahead of making it. My issue is that I don't think making new variant vaccines is the right approach. We're working on pan-coronavirus vaccines that I think will be a lot better. Teen Vogue. How would pan-coronavirus vaccines work? Weissman. It would involve finding a common target across all the COVID-19 variants or all the bat coronaviruses, and making a vaccine that induces a response to those targets so that it's protective against all variants or bat coronaviruses. Teen Vogue. In 2020, as the COVID vaccines were being developed, there was this optimism and expectation that the pandemic would soon end. But for a variety of reasons, that hasn't happened. So at this point, how does the pandemic end? Weissman. COVID is turning into an endemic disease. We'll never be rid of it. In the United States, 75% of people have two immunizations. 30% of people have three. In Africa, 25% of people are vaccinated. Germany is similar to the U.S. Other countries are much better. But if you wanted to get rid of COVID quickly, you would have needed to vaccinate 90% of the world, and that didn't happen. And it's never going to happen. So it's now an endemic disease. Hopefully, it will be like the flu, where every winter we have some COVID and we have some flu, we get vaccinated, and it's not too bad. Kiriko. Some people say, oh, your vaccine is not working because look at the disease, it's here. But 2 years ago, when you heard that somebody got infected, when we had no vaccine, you started to worry that they might die. And today, it's, so you tested positive? I did too. And you got a headache? I'm coughing. That's what it is. So the vaccine is still working. Teen Vogue. After mRNA was used successfully in the development of the Pfizer and Moderna COVID-19 vaccines, there has still been a lot of interest in utilizing the technology in other ways, especially since the first phase of a National Institute of Health clinical trial of three mRNA HIV vaccine candidates launched in March. Was HIV always one of the conditions mRNA technology was developed to target? Weissman. I've been working on RNA vaccines for HIV for over 20 years. We actually had two phase one clinical trials that started before the pandemic to treat HIV. Duke University, Moderna, and NIH are all conducting HIV vaccine clinical trials. Teen Vogue. What are some of the other diseases that could be prevented using a vaccine created using mRNA technology? Kiriko. Moderna has CMV, cytomegalovirus, RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, and influenza vaccines, already in advanced phase clinical trials. There are two types of mRNA vaccine candidates for Epstein-Barr virus, and there is also a plan for developing mRNA vaccines for many other diseases like tuberculosis and malaria. At BioNTech, we have a FixVac vaccine for cancer, which is tumor antigen specific. And together with Genentech, we have individualized cancer vaccines, which means that the vaccine is made only for that person who has that tumor. We sequence and identify what mutations are present and make specific mRNA coding for those neoantigens. Weissman. And we've been working on monkeypox vaccine. We're talking to BioNTech next week to see if they want to put in, if they see if they want to put it into a clinical trial. Teen Vogue. Beyond vaccines, how might mRNA technology be applied to treat different diseases? Weissman. We're developing RNA for making CAR T cells to fight cancer, for editing the genome, and for treating sickle cell anemia and inflammatory disorders of the lung, the brain, and the heart. The ultimate goal is treatment of brain neurodegenerative disorders. This, of course, is more difficult because you have to cross the blood-brain barrier, but we've done that. And now we're working on secondary targeting of specific cells in the brain. So it's not unbelievable that someday we can treat Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and other neurodegenerative diseases. I think over the next 5 years, you're going to see new RNA therapeutics for an enormous number of diseases. The next article is from The Teen Magazine, and it's titled, Why Every Teenager Must Read To Kill a Mockingbird. This is written by Maria Vietes and was published Friday, August 26th. Quote, mockingbirds don't do one thing but make music for us to enjoy. They don't eat up people's gardens. They don't nest in corn cribs. They don't do one thing but sing their hearts out for us. That's why it's a sin to kill a mockingbird. To Kill a Mockingbird, every English teacher's most appraised book, a classic literary work that's on everyone's must-read lists. But why is it that Harper Lee's most successful novel has had such an impact on society? What does it even mean to kill a mockingbird? This literary classic was first published in 1960 during the peak of the civil rights movement, and while the impact of segregation from the 30s was still prominent. Even after the end of the Civil War, racism had had a chokehold on society, and To Kill a Mockingbird, TCAM, manages to show day-to-day life in a small town in 1933 when discrimination was still accepted and normalized by communities in the South. Many other works, like The Heart is a Lonely Hunter and The Sound and the Fury, treat similar subjects to the ones portrayed in To Kill a Mockingbird, but the latter has the ability to mesmerizingly depict the menace of racism with an air of innocence and youth, making this masterpiece a life-changing coming-of-age story that every teenager should read. The plot behind A Lifetime Lesson. To Kill a Mockingbird is narrated by 6-year-old Scout Finch, and the book follows her life during 3 years of growth from Macomb, Alabama. This county is home to a community fed with gossip, chaos, and racism. In the Finch household resides Scout, Atticus Finch, Scout's father, Jem Finch, Scout's brother, and Calpurnia, the Finch's black maid. However, the house next door is also remarkable, since their neighbor, Boo Radley, is a main element in the story's life. Radley is a mysterious recluse who hasn't left his house since an incident in his childhood. This triggers the Finch children's curiosity, and eventually Boo reveals himself to be their savior. The heart of the plot, Atticus Finch, is a lawyer and the bearer of life lessons in this masterpiece. His words are caring and compassionate, and his morals are stronger than the town's judgment. His behavior is consistent with his beliefs. He is one of the few who aren't racist in Maycomb, but always remains humble with his wiseness. The personality of his becomes a conflict with his profession when a rape case in the town is brought to him. His client, a black man, allegedly raped a young white girl, and he is to defend the supposed aggressor. The case does not only have an effect on the plot and the characters, but also on the reader, because we find ourselves in a profuse internal conflict between believing the victim or breaking the racist stigma of all black citizens being guilty of crimes. The development of this case interferes with young Scout's childhood, and as an omniscient narrator and witness, her innocence is slowly murdered, hence The Killed Mockingbird in the book's title. Why the mockingbird? Remember, it's a sin to kill a mockingbird. What is this about? Upon first gaze at the book's title, one can barely guess what the plot will involve. It doesn't have much of a literal connection to the book itself. The metaphor and reference to a bird whose only occupation is singing leaves a blurry image of the book's content and cascading doubts about whether this book is worth your time, evade your mind. However, once the reader is submerged in the book, the meaning behind the title is revealed by the appearance of these fragments. Remember, it's a sin to kill a mockingbird. That was the only time I ever heard Atticus say it. It was a sin to do something. And I asked Miss Maudie about it. Your father's right, she said. Mockingbirds don't do one thing but make music for us to enjoy, but sing their hearts out for us. That's why it's a sin to kill a mockingbird. Atticus Finch allows Scout to fire a rifle as long as she remembers that mockingbirds aren't meant to be killed. Scout is tormented with questions about why she shouldn't kill such birds, and her neighbor explains that mockingbirds don't do any harm to humans. They don't deserve to be killed. Mockingbirds are innocent. At this moment, the reader realizes that the mockingbird is a reference to innocence, and the title of the book makes a reference to the murder and eradication of Scout's innocence, hence the killing of her mockingbird. However, the analysis of the mockingbird doesn't have to end simply by assuming that the mockingbird is the young girl's innocence, but it can also stand for the black people in Maycomb, or secluded minorities for that matter. The context of America during the setting of the book is filled with racism and segregation, and this book displays the innocence of these targeted people. This being said, Harper Lee was also expressing through her literature that with every discrimination and attack toward an innocent black person, a sin was being committed, a lesson that, to modern society, is still vital. A revolutionary book. Quote, Lee is nostalgic for the sweetness and light of her youth, but she's also unflinching in her critiques of the bitterness and ignorance that characterizes social and race relations. That combination of nostalgia and criticism is what makes Mockingbird both endearing and enduring. John Green. It is no surprise that To Kill a Mockingbird has won a Pulitzer Prize, kept its impact through the years, and that worldwide, people keep becoming amazed by this artwork. Doubtless, the most admirable and enthralling characteristic of the narration is the ability to depict racism in the eyes of innocence and childhood. The book displays the honest awakening and bursting of the childhood bubble that growing up involves, showing from the raw point of view of a young girl in the process. The manner in which it is written creates an easy path into the reader's heart, and the dismal but self-contemplating sensation of traveling back in time to a small town in the time of segregation is indelible. Finally, it has managed to express the coexistence of good and evil, whilst keeping humanity alive and using an alleviating and tender approach when breaking reality, making it a perfect coming-of-age book that teenagers can't overlook. The author of this article, Maria Vaitez, has an undeniable passion for reading and writing. In her free time, she enjoys weightlifting, learning German, managing her small business, and embracing the literary aspects of her life. She hopes to pursue a journalism career and dedicate her life to the production of creative writing. And the last article from The Teen Magazine, How the Heat Waves Across the World Pose Serious Issues. This op-ed is written by Olivia C., and it was published Friday, August 26th. The Earth is burning? This is the typical question that crosses the average human's mind when discussing the Earth's increasing surface temperature and its prevalent heat waves. To be frank, it is impossible to turn on a modern news station without hearing the urgent cries of climate change activists and the less than fortunate people it often affects. At that moment, though, it isn't atypical for viewers to turn off the television and walk away and to pretend that it doesn't affect them solely because of who they are. Or maybe the viewer is an intermittent empath and does feel pain and worry for those that will die at the hands of climate change. At that moment, perhaps they cry and wail like babies, then get wind of the immediate danger that faces all human life. And then something might catch their eye or distract their mind, something that they hold in high regard or deem more interesting. And despite the empathy they once had, they go right back to where they started, indifferent. While China is breaking temperature records with heat reaching 113 degrees, most people are sleeping peacefully in their beds, ignoring the crisis that affects humans worldwide. And while nearly 1,600 people in America die of heat exhaustion, most people are eating, relaxing, and giving attention to things that share no relation to the future of the planet. Most activists and advocates would rush to educate their listeners about the climate emergency. I, however, believe it's best to approach this topic in chunks. Like a meal, you can digest a crisis one in one bite. You can't digest a crisis in one bite. I'd specifically like to shine some light on the beast that is heat waves. What are heat waves? According to NOAA, a heat wave is a period of unusually hot weather that typically lasts two or more days. What is the impact? Heat waves are also detrimental to the commercial and economic industries. The agriculture heat waves can increase livestock deaths, lower cattle reproduction rates, and increase the change of a decline in milk production. The worst part about an entire crisis isn't the fact that it's occurring. Instead, it's the fact that heat waves are becoming the norm. The way we define the concurring heat wave is there are any that is that there are any two regions in the mid-latitude that are simultaneously experiencing large heat waves, and that this occurs almost every day in the summer season. The same article discusses the slow yet obvious progression of heat waves expansion internationally. What can be done? Oh, wait, hold on, sorry. In the 1980s, heat waves only occurred for 20 to 30 days each summer. Now the occurrence of heat waves is six times as likely and covers about 46% more. It's 46% more space for 46% more space than 40 years ago. According to the Centers for Climate Change and Energy Solutions, heat waves can cause heat stress and heat-related illnesses and mortality. Nearly 600 people have died of heat waves just this year. What can be done? However, it is never too late to take action. Being conscious of greenhouse gases and efficient energy sources is a good start to the journey that is environmental conservation. Planting vegetation is a great way to lower surface temperatures and reduce the likelihood of the formation of heat waves. Most importantly, reach out. Communicating with nonprofits devoted to environmental conservation, such as 350.org, the Environmental Defense Fund, and Climate Works are great ways to find opportunities to make a difference and shine some light on what could be a very gloomy future. The generations that are soon to come may never remember their forefathers, but they will remember the impact their forefathers' actions had on their quality of life. And it is imperative to stay educated. It is important to be vigilant and intentional about everything you do, because every decision made regarding the environment affects our future as well as our present. The author of this article is named Olivia C. Olivia C. is a writer from Tennessee. She is passionate about entertainment and social journalism and is incredibly grateful for the opportunity to write for the Teen magazine. Okay, well, we have come to the end of today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Please be sure to tune in next time to Teen Magazine. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.